Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, where Professor Efrain Inbar makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute, and thanks to the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council for making it possible for our speaker to be here tonight. I'll introduce him briefly. Professor Inbar is Director of the Begin Sadat Centre of Strategic Studies in Israel. He's Professor in Political Studies at Bar-Ilan University. His area of specialisation is Middle East strategic issues, with a special interest in the politics and strategy of Israeli national security. Our speaker's written over 800 articles, authored five books and edited many volumes, so he's widely published in the area. And today we asked Professor Inbar to speak about the issue of Israeli politics today, but he'll take questions beyond that when we come to questions and discussion. So, Professor Inbar, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for inviting me here. It's a pleasure to be in Australia, despite the fact it's very far from home. And I will speak about, as mentioned, Israeli politics today, and I'll elaborate on three themes.
You need to speak up a bit.
Okay. Yes, I'll elaborate on three themes. One is that there is great consensus in Israel on many issues, despite what the newspapers are telling. Second, that Netanyahu is probably the only game in town. And third, that as long as national security issues will be dominant in Israeli politics, the Likud party has a good chance to continue to lead the state of Israel. Now, about great consensus. When I was a student many years ago, I have white hair, we were taught that there are several cleavages in Israeli society. And if I look back, those cleavages are no longer there. First of all, in terms of economy, probably you remember that once Israel was a socialist state. It's no longer so, and probably everybody is happy about it because we are all good capitalists. And if there was a cleavage about how the economy should be run, this cleavage is no longer there. And economic issues, in ideological terms, is no longer an issue in Israeli politics. Another cleavage which we were learning at the university was the cleavage between Jews coming from Africa, Asia countries, and the Jews coming from Europe. Ashkenazi vis-a-vis Sephardi Jews. This is also no longer an issue in Israeli politics. You know, I teach at the university. I hardly know who is who. A third of the marriages in Israel is what we call intermarriages, not what's called here intermarriage. And because, you know, Jews from different origins are meeting in different places, they marry, and it's almost of no consequence. It still has a consequence in ultra-Orthodox circles, but basically, this is not an issue. The issue is, you know, what kind of education you got, what kind of social background you come from, economic background, but the origin of a Jew that was an issue in Israeli politics, and there were issues of discrimination, this is no longer an issue. Actually, we are absorbing rather successfully Ethiopian Jews, who are African Jews from Africa, very distinct in their color. I see already Ethiopians that are officers in the paratroopers. and this is up in the ladder to social mobility. Israel is indeed very successful in integrating, due to its education system, also due to the basic tolerance in Israeli society, a variety of Jews that came from so many countries. Another important issue which was divided the Israeli society is what to do about the territories that were conquered in 1967. If we take a look at what's happening now, Sinai Desert is no longer an issue. It was returned to Egypt fully in 1979. We have a peace treaty with Egypt, which surprisingly is holding well. It went through many difficulties, many tests. So Sinai is no longer an issue. The Golan Heights actually was never a real issue of division in Israeli society, because most Israelis, I can speak about 70-80%, supported the 1981 Israeli government decision to annex the Golan Heights. And when we look nowadays at what's happening in Syria, it is quite clear to everybody that even if there was a sort of returning part of the land to Syria, there is no longer a Syria to return to. By the way, the most convincing argument for keeping the Golan Heights is, of course, the famous winery we have on the Golan Heights. I suggest, you know, if you want to help Israeli economy, buy those wines, and I'm sure you'll enjoy them. They compete with Australian wines, by the way. Kosher is Australian wines. Now about the West Bank. Gaza is also gone. In 2005, Ariel Sharon decided on a unilateral withdrawal, and we all know what happened. Hamas took over, and obviously most Israelis have no appetite whatsoever to go into Gaza. We are also not very welcome there. So the West Bank, there are no real divisions in Israeli society. Most of the Israelis are ready for territorial concessions. Not the territorial concessions the Palestinian Authority wants, but most of the Israelis are ready to give up a large part of the West Bank, are ready to part from this territory, which we consider, of course, our homeland. And at the same time, the same majority, I'm talking about 60-70%, understand that there is no partner. This is a mantra that every Israeli knows. Since year 2000, since the failure of the Camp David Accords, Camp David Summit between Ehud Barak, at that time Israel's Prime Minister, and Yasser Arafat, the leader of the Palestinian National Movement, that failed. And then the result was an intifada, a campaign of terror. Since then, Israelis understand that there is no partner, there is no serious Palestinian partner that can negotiate with Israel a compromise, a historic compromise between the Zionist movement and the Palestinian National Movement that will satisfy both sides. So there is consensus even on the issues that most of the world thinks that we are fighting about. We do not fight about. We understand very well that if there will be a partner, we'll make concessions. But unfortunately, there is no real partner. By the way, on this issue, the labor leader, Herzog, just last week made his view quite clear to the president of France, telling him the two-state solution is a nice idea, but it's not implementable in the near future. He was criticized by the radical left in Israel. But Labor, on the left, of course, Likud, Netanyahu gave his famous two-state speech at my center. And we are ready for a two-state solution. But in the meantime, we have a three-state solution. We have Gaza, a political entity separate from the Palestinian Authority, and Israel. So this is not a real issue of ideological issue. The movement for greater Israel, that ideologically thinks that this is part of our homeland and there is no reason whatsoever to give it up, is no longer a potent force in Israeli politics. There is another historic cleavage. This is a cleavage between the more religious people and the secularists in Israel. This cleavage has not disappeared. We still have a lot of debates which are not that different from identity debates in other countries. In the United States, we have debates over issues that have religious connotation, abortions, same-sex marriages. Those issues are debated in Israel. And there's clear, division. But we should remember that this is not a dichotomy. It's not a religious camp vis-a-vis a secular camp. We have a continuum in Israeli politics. We have religious, about 25% of the population, another 35-40%, maybe more, of what it's called traditionalists, who have keep a variety of religious injunctions, and we have the religious secularists. And the religious secularists are diminishing in numbers because, simple fact, they have a child and a dog. While the rest of the population has more children. This is their decision, which is not that different from decisions in other Western countries. And demographics are our world. So basically, the country has become more traditional, more religious over time. And the secularists have a difficult time in Israel to cope with this new reality. I have colleagues, friends, and among them there are people that have a terrible feeling. This country is no longer theirs. Once they were the elite, they were the calling the shots in the country, and now it's a different country in many ways. And it's no longer there. And this is, of course, this type of frustration is not healthy for politics. There is another issue which we have to recognize, the difference between poor and rich. As Israel became more affluent, and we are living well, thank God, this gap between the rich and the poor is growing. And in terms of OECD countries, Israel is part of the OECD group, we probably are one of the countries with the largest gap between poor and rich. And this is a political problem everywhere. However, Israel still have the remnants of a welfare state. As I mentioned, we were once a socialist state that to some extent cushions the aspects of this problem. Moreover, the Likud ruling party since 1977, more or less, most of the time, is actually quite sensitive to this issue because a large part of the voters for Likud are the working class. The working class in Israel, as in other countries, don't vote socialist. Probably they have good reason for not voting so. Fortunately for Israel, in the last years also, the unemployment is rather low, below 5%, which you really can't get lower than that. This, again, because of the growth of the Israeli economy, unemployment is low, and this, to some extent, attenuates the problem between rich and poor. Generally, if I take a look at the Israeli society, and there are polls, you know, about happy countries, Israel is one of the most happiest countries in the world. It rates among the first 10 countries. Israelis are happy to be in Israel. We have terrorism, we have wars, but somehow there are other aspects of Israeli life that compensate for those troubles, and we are usually faring number 7, 8 among the happiest countries in the world. I'll move now to the second theme, leadership. Benjamin Netanyahu is the most popular politician in Israel. And he has a high rate of support. I would say also that Bibi is probably the only game in town. He has been prime minister since 2007. He had a previous stint, 96 to 99. And, you know, I follow politicians. He has a learning curve. He doesn't make the same mistake twice. You know, he makes mistakes like every politician, but he's able to recuperate, and he's actually much more adept at domestic politics than it was during the first stint. And this, of course, helps him keep his party more or less happy. You know, people have ambitions, and they are hungry for positions, but he can deal with it. There are no real contenders inside the Likud for his position. In Israel, we don't have this type of semi-coup d'etat when a prime minister in the middle of the parliamentary terms has to go and somebody else replaces him. You are familiar with this phenomenon here. I don't know if Netanyahu took a look at Australian politics, but it doesn't happen there. Actually, the people that are contenders leave the party. I think they are wrong by leaving the party. They are impatient. But some of the, for example, Saar, I don't know if you know the names, was a very popular politician, or Kahlon, who is now Minister of Finance, running on a separate party, were members of Likud, and they left. And I think by leaving the party, they, to some extent, lost the chance to gain a leadership position in Likud, which is the ruling party. They are members of, or leaders of, marginal parties. Also, those contenders to leadership position, Netanyahu sends them abroad. One of them is ambassador to the UN, you know, far away from Israel, and he doesn't have to deal with, you know, domestic inside opposition. And there are some that are patient. One patient politician in Israel that was a good politician was Ariel Sharon. He never left the position. He never demonstrated his unwillingness to go along with the leader getting out of the government. No, he stayed. And he used to say, you know, it's a circle. Once you are up, once you are down, but eventually it goes back. Also, outside Likud, there is no real contender for leadership position. And if you ask the people, and there are many polls, who is suitable to be prime minister, nobody gets close to Netanyahu. If we take a look at, I just saw a poll just before I came, on Friday, then we have the polls for the weekend newspapers. The centrist Lapid is becoming stronger. Labor leader Herzog, that comes from a political family, his father was president, is becoming weaker. Maybe he will turn to the center. You have to be centrist in order to win elections. This is true in most political systems. And one problem of Labor was that it turned too much to the left. The polls show quite clearly, if there were elections today, the Likud would have taken the same proportion of Knesset seats as during the last elections. And, you know, as an outsider of politics, I just observe politics. For a short time, I was a member of a student, you know, party, and there were all the time elections, so I gave up on politics. You know, everybody wants to be the head of the... So I'm just an observer. And I understand that, you know, having Netanyahu as the only game in town is not a healthy phenomenon. Despite the fact that I support Netanyahu. We probably have a problem in recruiting leadership, you know, politicians for this type of career. And it takes time to nourish a politician in order to become a prime minister, particularly in a country like Israel, which has a lot of problems. So we have a weakness in our political system that I don't know how it will be overcome. Netanyahu now enjoys a coalition of 61 seats in Knesset out of 120. This is what's called in political science a minimum coalition. And many people think that this is an unstable coalition. Actually, it is not. Even the literature about this type of coalitions shows that 61, the minimum coalition, is a stable coalition because everybody wants to be part of the government. And there are people who, of course, prime ministerial aspirations. I mentioned Kahlon, but it's a satellite party. He had the satellite party of Likud. Right-wing Bennett, he's the head of the Beit Yehudi, the Jewish home, the religious party. He is in the wrong party. He wants basically to be in Likud in order to run for leadership, but he's there. Those are the partners of Netanyahu nowadays. And of course the ultra-Orthodox. And the ultra-Orthodox are actually natural partners for almost every prime minister. Because what they want is very clear and limited. They want money. Money for their own projects. It doesn't matter. And, you know, governments do not hesitate to give money for support. And actually, their demands are rather limited and manageable, particularly with in a country that has become more affluent, has more money. They go along with Netanyahu. Not all the leadership in the party, but basically the ultra-Orthodox electorate prefers Likud. And Netanyahu, if I look at his record, he's very good on economy. He liberalized the Israeli economy. He's identified with the big jump in Israeli economic progress. People are have a job. Most people are not political. They want to work. They want a salary. And they get economic security. He was successful in, you know, it was not easy. We have a lot of red tape, remnants of the socialist heritage, and there was a big gas deal to be approved. We found gas in the Eastern Mediterranean, and there were elements in the Israeli political system that wanted to tax more, to get more money out of the companies, and this issue was dragged for several years. Eventually, Netanyahu, through various political machinations, made the deal, which will bring about greater sources to the government and to Israel. tremendous economic sources. I'll move now to the third subject. I'll do it fast in order to meet your deadline. In terms of foreign policy, Israelis have a real political orientation. Most of them understand that politics is about power, understand that the region in which we live is a region that military force is part and parcel of the rules of the game, understand that use of force is popular in the populace of the Arabs around us, and they trust Likud, and particularly Netanyahu, to do well on those issues. On national security issues, on defense issues. One important issue that Israelis are very sensitive is the relationship with the United States, the big ally, and of course a crisis happened between us and the Americans because of the Iranian nuclear deal. And Netanyahu was not afraid to go to Washington and criticize the president. This didn't go very well in Israeli politics. Many were apprehensive because we are very sensitive to this relationship. Still, he went again to Washington and Netanyahu was accepted by Obama, and this time he gave him dinner, in contrast to other times. And the relation seems well, despite the fact that there is a problem in American-Israel relation. Just last week, we saw a demonstration of the foreign policy acumen of Netanyahu, this alliance between Greece, Cyprus, and Israel in the East Mediterranean to make sure that the gas goes to Europe. To some extent, it's anti-Turkish alliance. And the architect of this alliance is Netanyahu, obviously Netanyahu. Of course, it also shows to the Israeli left that Israel is not that as isolated as people on the left are claiming. Netanyahu has been pushing Israel towards the east. He made India, China, Australia a clear priority for Israeli foreign policy, understanding very well that the international action is moving to the Pacific Rim. And he gets good grades for it. Actually, nowadays, Israel has relatively good relations with the moderate Arab states. We never had a better relations with Egypt than today. They face a real problem of Islamic radicalism in Sinai and in Egypt itself. Jordan has been our traditional strategic partner for decades. Even Saudi Arabia are doing more and more things in public with Israelis. Of course, if we need air corridor, they'll be happy to supply us. And I'm sure that if we send a check, they'll pay for it. The Gulfies as well. The Gulf states are now more openly willing to do business with Israel. Israeli businessmen are working in the Gulf, not with Israeli passports, but Israelis are pragmatic. We find, you know, the right passport. Again, Israel is doing very well. In Europe, we have a problem. And for a variety of reasons, which I don't have time to go into, but Europe is less important. Anybody is willing to invest in a euro today? I don't think that, you know, I'm not a big economist, but I wouldn't put my money on the euro. At the bilateral level, by the way, Israeli relations with countries like France, Germany, of course, Britain, and particularly the Eastern Europeans that have always been more sensitive to Israeli national security issues because they remember the Russians, and they still see, you know, a threat from Putin and Russia. They have good relations with us. They buy weapons from us, and there's a lot of things going on. So even in this area, which is a forte of Netanyahu, Israel is doing relatively well. And you know, let me finish it. As long as national security issues are dominant in Israeli politics, not social issues, people vote on national security issues. Likud has a better chance in the next elections, and I don't know what will come. We are the choosing people, and we have too many elections. But Likud is doing actually very well. Thank you.
Many thanks. So thanks, Professor Inbar, and thanks for keeping precisely the time. So we've got to the top of the hour.
I knew about your reputation.
You've heard about it. It's widely known throughout Israel, actually, yeah. And beyond. Yeah. So thanks for that. And so we got to the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. So you just come back here and talk to the bottom of the room. So if I could just start off, Anne and I were in Israel last in about 14 months ago, just before the election, and it was widely held both outside Israel, but also within parts of Israel. Experts were telling us that Netanyahu couldn't get up again, but he did. So what were some of the polls wrong? Were the experts wrong? Or were some people were supporting Netanyahu who didn't want to say that they were doing so to pollsters or commentators? How do you describe his, what I think was, to many people, a surprise victory?
I'm not sure I have all the answers, but it's a widely known phenomenon that polls before elections are not always a good predictor of the election results. It happened in other countries as well. In Israel, I think that there is a part of the electorate that will never tell a pollster what he thinks. You know, Jews coming from Russia. You know, the NKVD was asking questions, you know, how they know they cannot tell the truth, you know. And we are talking about 20% of the electorate, which can cause, and we know about it. We know about this phenomenon, that the Russian vote is. I think also that there was, before the elections, people voted for the, or hoped to vote for their pet parties, but realizing that maybe Netanyahu will lose the election and the right-wing bloc will lose its grip over power, they decided to move back to Netanyahu. It's quite clear that the Beit Hayyudi, the National Religious Party, lost a third of its voters to Netanyahu in the last days of before the election, in the election campaign. And I think Netanyahu is a very good campaigner. And, you know, you need a good campaigner to bring in the troops, to vote. And he has it. He's a good speaker also.
So there's a question. Don't stand in front of the camera. If I repeat your comment, it's because I feel we can't pick it up in the pod. So, yeah.
Professor, you mentioned earlier that there wasn't a feasible partner for negotiating for a two-state system. To what extent is Israel very concerned about the fact that there was a Palestinian state, that there's a great danger of becoming a failed state, like so many other nations in the Middle East? And to what extent would Israel be willing to see Jordan take on a greater amount of the West Bank?
So the issue is, to what extent is the prospect of a Palestinian state becoming a failed state, and might Jordan be a partner for Israel in this kind of resolving this kind of problem?
Well, I think that the Palestinian Authority is a failed state. What's a failed state? A political entity with no monopoly over use of force. And if there are militias and one militia, they're fighting against each other and one militia takes over, This is exactly what happened to the Palestinian Authority. Hamas, one militia, they allowed, you know, the emergence of Hamas. Arafat played with the Hamas. They took over part of the Palestinian territories in Gaza. And there is no longer a Palestinian entity. Even in Gaza, there is no monopoly over use of force. We have Islamic Jihad there. We have ISIS elements. We have clans with weapons. And to some extent, the Palestinian political body reflects what's happening in the rest of the Arab world. The Arab political culture probably has a problem in sustaining statist structures, and this is part of our problem vis-a-vis the Palestinians. We have failed states all over, you know, it's Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Lebanon, Libya. So the Palestinians, you know, being Arabs, are not that different from the rest of the Arab population. We are very concerned about it. But what can we do? You know, we simply are waiting to see the emergence, maybe of a more astute political leadership there that is able to bring about a historic compromise between the two national movements. So far, we didn't see it. There are no Ben-Gurions on the other side.
And Jordan?
myself, I would love to see the Jordanians take over part of the West Bank and deal with the Palestinians, you know, with Arab methods, not being constrained as we are being in a democracy. But I'm not sure they are very enthusiastic about such a prospect. And who wants Palestinians? You know, that's a fact of life. They don't want. We would love to see Egypt return to Gaza. Not too many takers, you know, for Hamas.
Right down the back, up against the window. Yeah. No, hang on. No, it's down here. Right down the. No, one behind you. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I understand the religious Jews that are exempted from military service are an increasing proportion of the population. Do you see that as a problem leading to long term?
Suggestion, religious Jews being free from conscription, is this a problem in the long term in Israel?
I think the greater problem is that part of the Israeli population, the ultra-Orthodox men, and Arab women are not part of the working force. And Israel is fully aware of this problem, is doing a lot of efforts, spending money, having programs to train them in order to become part of the working force. This is a gradual process, it will take time. And we see, by the way, also an increase in the number of ultra-Orthodox that joins the army. We established special units for them with more dietary, kosher rules for laws for them. Also, knowing their sensitivities, they don't have women as instructors in most units. We have women as instructors, so we try to be sensitive to their idiosyncrasies, but this I think gradually is changing. The ultra-Orthodox realize that they cannot continue this. It's also against the Jewish instinct to be poor. Jews don't want to be poor. They are going to work and they are going to eventually to make money.
So get on the back again, we'll be where then.
Yes. The settlements on the West Bank, an insurmountable barrier or obstacle to peace.
Are the settlements an insurmountable obstacle to peace?
I think the issue of settlement is overblown. And I'll tell you why. First of all, in terms of territory, maybe 7-8% of the West Bank is the settlements. And we shouldn't look at the settlements, we should look at the number of settlers. Most of the settlers live near what's called the Green Line, the former 67 border. And I think there is a clear understanding in the international community that those settlement blocks will be part of Israel in a future agreement. Now there are other settlements spread out in the West Bank. If a Palestinian state will be established, I see no reason why part of them, if they wish to do so, to stay within a Palestinian state. Why must a Palestinian state be Judenrein? I think the Palestinian demand to remove all settlers, which is backed by part of the international community, is a racist policy, which is not acceptable. Why can't a Jew live what he considers part of the homeland? He can live in Australia, he can live in New York, but not in Jericho, not in the place where our prophets walked. So I think it's overblown. I think Israel, by the way, is, as I mentioned before, is ready to make concession, including removal of settlements. The Israeli government has a good record in removing settlements. We removed settlements in as part of the Egyptian Israeli peace treaty. We removed settlements in Gaza unilaterally, also in the West Bank, by Ariel Sharon. So we can do it if it's necessary, but removal of all is, in my view, a totally unacceptable demand.
There's a question here, and then we go down the back here.
Professor, in regard to the media's portrayal of Israel, in Western countries this is very bad. Mainstream media in the US, very anti-Israel. Twitter deletes posts. Zuckerberg, who runs Facebook, is clearly anti-Israel. And you're facing 4 or 8 more years of left-wingers in the White House, possibly. Does this matter, or we don't care what people say about us as Israelis?
I think that indeed part of the media, a large part of the media, doesn't understand the Middle East. And therefore, it accepts simplistic views and are blaming Israel for many things. You can take a look, at what times they grew up, what universities they went, So this is a professional disease that we have to live with. In the media, it's not going to change anytime soon. How important is the media? Is New York Times that influential? Listen, most of the Americans don't read the New York Times. They don't care about what's written in the New York Times. Israel has been subject to criticism for many years. By the way, when were the Jews popular? No, we have a long history. So we are to some extent immune to this type of criticism. We can live with it. The UN is a terrible institution. It's a morally bankrupt institution that voted, it's obsessed with Israel. We can live with this Judophobia in many places. I think what is important is, what we do. What people say about us may have some effect, but eventually what Israel is doing is the most important factor. And, for example, excessive use of force and all those things, I think it's terrible what they're saying about us out of ignorance. I was a combat soldier for many years. I have a son who was a part of. I know exactly what kind of measure Israel is taking in order to prevent collateral damage. There is no army in the world that takes greater measures we telephone people. You know how much time it takes to telephone, to collect the telephone numbers? Muhammad, are you still in your home? Please leave because soon we come in. We knock, we have missiles that knock on the roof. Do no damage. Warning people, get out. It's incredible what Israeli military is doing in order not only to fulfill the rules of belligerents, to go much behind it, and actually to some extent have too many lawyers in our army. Incredible, at the battalion level we have an officer that deals with law, which to some extent limits the effectiveness of Israeli military action. Every target is approved by a lawyer. Of course, mistakes can happen. It's a war. And still they are telling those stories. And what is most important for me as an Israeli on those issues, to be able to look in the mirror and to say, I did all right. That's the most important thing. I can live with it. Of course, there are things that, you know, we are not holy people, you know. Sometimes we make mistakes. Of course, you can criticize. But generally, some of the criticism is totally unfounded.
We get on the back, right up against the wall, 1, 2, 3, and over here. Okay, well, all right. Now, I've got to be quick, okay?
Professor, we know the Aussie relationship between Netanyahu and Obama. Who would the Israelis like to see as the next president on the
list? Anything but Obama.
So you get that.
So maybe we get our wish. Netanyahu, by the way, made a mistake previous elections in supporting a candidate, and it was a mistake, and we paid for it to some extent. So this is one weakness of some Israeli politicians, that they think they know the American scene very well because they've been so much there. And this time we keep out of it, and we'll live. You know, it's. I just hope that Obama is just a historic accident and not a trend in American politics.
So we come one up from there, then we go across to here and back to there. Yep, down there. Okay, yeah.
Professor, what do you believe will need to happen first in order for the Palestinian Authority and Israel to actually find lasting peace? And do you believe that will happen in our lifetime?
But the question is there any prospect of Israel and the PA finding lasting peace?
You know, I'll tell you a story. I was asked a similar question when I gave a lecture on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in a Greek think tank in Athens. And he said, don't you have enough? And I asked a simple question, how many years did you fight the Turks? I knew the answer. It was 300 years. So comparatively to the Greek-Turkish dispute, we are a young conflict. And this type of conflicts, ethnic religious conflicts, do not end easily. The most important reason why we will not see a historic compromise in the near future is that the both societies, the Israeli and the Palestinian society, still have a lot of energies to fight over things that are important to them. For you, probably, peace, lasting peace, is the most important value. This is not the most important value for Israelis or for Palestinians. And unless you understand that, you cannot understand the intensity of the conflict and its longevity.
There's a question here. Yeah.
How serious is the problem of the anti-Israeli Arab members of the Knesset? Because in some countries, the sort of talk that we hear from them would be considered seriously seditious.
Question about the members of the Arab members of the Knesset who oppose Israel. The Knesset being the Israeli parliament.
We have, I believe, 12 out of 120 Arab Knesset members elected on an Arab list. There are additional Arab members of other parties. And they usually use very harsh rhetoric against Israel. We live with it. I think that we are a democracy. We have no intention of not allowing them to speak. It's not always nice to hear it, but I must say, at the same time, there is a periodic streak among those. And for example, now Netanyahu just allocated, I think, $2 billion of dollars for the Arab sector, and he made a deal with the Arab Knesset members, because on one hand we have this type of talk, and on the other hand there is pragmatic dealings in the Knesset on allocating budgets and things like that. So I think the Arab Knesset members do disservice to their electorate, and if they would be more part of the system, they would be better off, you know, in many ways. But this is their choice, and we are it's a democracy. Let's face it.
Given the destabilized environment there in the Middle East, what sorts of do you give towards the longevity of Saudi Arabia as the bulwark between the Shiites and the Baath?
Question about the longevity of Saudi Arabia.
I'm not an expert on the domestic politics of Saudi Arabia. But it's quite obvious that the type of problems other Arab states have might happen also in Saudi Arabia. Not only that, if you take a look at you know, at the composition of the Saudi population, a large part of the population in the eastern province in Saudi Arabia, which is, has most of the oil, is Shiite. And they are obviously susceptible to infiltration from Iran. Iran is, you know, is in north of Saudi Arabia, in Iraq. You know, Iraq is a satellite of Iran nowadays. The Saudis just executed a Shiite cleric that demanded basically that the eastern province should be carved out of Saudi Arabia and join Bahrain, which has a Shiite majority. It may happen. This will be, of course, a big blow to the stability, what is left of the stability of the region. But it may happen. I have at my center an expert on Saudi Arabia, Josh Teitelbaum. He says that the chances for dismemberment of Saudi Arabia are very slim. So there are different views about it. The possibility is there.
So we're getting close to the end of this question, and the question here, I think that's it. Yep.
How influential are internal critics in Israel from the left, such as Shlomo Sand, who criticize Zionism and even Jewish identity? Does anybody listen to him, or is he not important at all?
How influential are the left-wing critics in Israel of the state of Israel?
Well, I think that over 90% of Israelis have never heard about Zant. And his ridiculous, you know, thesis that, you know, there was no Jewish people. So the left has limited influence because it's very small, it's isolated. It has diminishing influence over the years. Haaretz, you know, who reads Haaretz in Israel? You know, it's read outside, you know. This is part of the frustration of the radical left. Not only that they are not recognized, they have no influence, and this is precisely why part of the radical left is going abroad. to try. They lost faith in the Israeli democracy. Basically, they say the people, you know, we have to change the people, but they can't change the people. So they try to impose a solution, you know, in what they think it's a solution, by outside powers. This is exactly what is happening. And we have Israeli organizations funded by Europeans that are doing exactly that. They are working primarily abroad, trying to convince foreign governments to try to impose a solution that the Israeli democracy has rejected, or is rejecting.
Found a question here.
Now, in the last week or so, there's again discussion in Israeli political newspapers, whatever, about the tunnels. It's back. People are talking about hearing the tunnel underneath. One collapsed the other day on a group of Hamas. And Netanyahu, I think, has said that the retaliation this time will be much, much more severe than last time. Is this shadow boxing, or is it becoming another? Is it coming back as an action that we'll see in the future?
So, question about the tunnels coming out of Gaza again.
I have to say that Netanyahu is not trigger happy. He's very hesitant to use force. We've seen it last time in 2014, summer of 2014. He ordered, after a while, you know, a very limited invasion of Gaza. The invasion was 800 meters, that's it, to go after the tunnels. So, you know, we have to take this type of declarations with a grain of salt. And I think that, you know, I'm unorthodox on this issue. I don't think the tunnels are such a big issue. The problem is that, you know, it's low tech. Again, the problem is low tech for a country, high tech country like Israel. And we have not found yet the technological solution to identify tunnels. We are working on it. It may take time, more time than people thought it will take. And, you know, what can a tunnel do? Now, let's face it. They can bring in 10, 15 people and perpetrate terrorist activities. But eventually it will be localized and they will be taken care of. So nobody wants to be victim of terrorism, but terrorism is a weapon of the weak. And if we take a look at the history of terrorism, terrorism does not win. Therefore, we should put the tunnels in the right strategic proportion.
Many thanks. Just step aside for a second. Look, there were more questions, but we always try to finish on time, and we're coming up to time. So thanks to Colin Rubenstein and Anthony Orkin at AJAC for making this possible today. Thanks to Professor Imbar for a very important analysis, a pragmatic analysis of Israel and Israeli politics. He's a pragmatist, giving a pragmatic analysis, which is really just what we want. We're interested in the facts and our speaker's interpretation of the facts, and that's what we got tonight. So it'll be a good paper when it's all typed up and put in the Sydney papers online. And it's on our podcast and on APAC as well. So many thanks for coming here tonight. You just stopped the plane from Israel, for sharing your views, and have a great time in Australia, and we'll see you back sometime in the future. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.